Welcome to the Prophet University audio series. Here are your hosts, Bill Kennard and Tom Grandy.
Welcome to the Prophet University audio series. I'm Bill Kennard, along with our company's founder, Tom Grandy. This month's program is titled Six Pillars of IT Security. This month is a real treat. I'll be interviewing Todd Tollier. Todd is with an IT management company, the company that Grandy & Associates has been using for years to take care of our IT service needs. Todd is going to be sharing details concerning the six pillars of IT security.
Bill, this really is an excellent interview. Research shows that a third of all IT attacks are on businesses with less than 100 employees. Well, that's the bulk of all American businesses. Think about this. What would the consequences be if your company was down for 2 or 3 days? What if you lost some or all of your data and records? That's why IT security is so critically important. This presentation will provide a wealth of must-know information.
Well, Tom, Todd really does provide some insightful information on how to manage those six pillars of IT security. You know, all too often, company owners think, we're just a small company. Who would want to hack into our system? Well, business owners, no matter the size of the company, need to pay attention to their IT security and will definitely benefit from this program. Todd is the manager of the IT services team at Insight Services. He has been doing IT in some capacity for 15 years and has been doing IT consulting for the past 9 years. He works with businesses of all sizes and industries. Todd's main focus is to ensure security is being implemented as a part of any conversation. And now with the six pillars of IT security, here's Todd Tollier with this month's Prophet University audio series presentation.
You know, Todd, at one point in my career, I used to really like computers, playing with them, seeing what we can make them do, and you know, networking them, getting all that stuff working together. And now you fast forward 25, 30 years, and man, as a business owner, that is such a challenge.
Yeah, it is. It's challenging. There's a lot to it. When you think about my computers, my data, my network, the infrastructure part of it, there's a lot to know. There's a lot to be aware of. There's a lot to worry about. But you as a business owner really shouldn't necessarily be being the one worrying about the minutiae of it. You should be conscious of it. You should be aware that all this stuff exists, and it's somewhat my responsibility to protect that and keep it safe. But you really should be relying on an expert who is in that world every day to kind of guide you.
Yeah, but you know, one of the things I look at is you know, we're not a huge company, right? We've only got a couple of machines around here. Do I really need to be paying attention? I mean, how critical is it that I'm worrying about that?
You know, I get that. That's unfortunately still a common misconception with small business owners. The stats don't really back up that small businesses aren't attacked. I mean, 40% or 46% of all cyber attacks impact businesses with less than 1,000 employees, and 30% or 37% of ransomware attacks actually hit companies with less than 100 employees. So, you know, the mindset that these malicious...
So less than 100 employees, I mean, that's the vast majority of companies across the country.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the mindset that these malicious actors have is Fortune 500 companies have Fortune 500 security budgets. So although the payoff is a lot more for those really large organizations, they're a lot harder to hit and really have success in attacking. They know that these smaller businesses maybe have the mindset that, you know, maybe they don't think that they're targets, they have less resources, less money to stick into it. Therefore, although the payoff can be less, there's a lot more of them and they're a lot easier to essentially get into.
Yeah, but really, I mean, it's different when you're trying to target, right?
Yeah.
Or hit, you know, someplace like that versus, you know, our little company. What's somebody gonna get from our little company?
You know, it's funny that you bring up Target. Back in 2013 was one of the largest data breaches in recent memory. Target in Pennsylvania was actually hit in December of 2013, right during the holiday season, and they were perpetrated by actually going through an HVAC vendor that Target used. So instead of targeting Target directly, they targeted an HVAC company that they were known to work with, and then because that HVAC company had access into Target's network, they used that entryway to get into Target's network, and it costed them over $200 million.
So it was actually the link that the HVAC contractor used to access the equipment, which is also tied into their network so they can access the equipment.
Exactly. I know because, you know, we work with some HVAC customers ourselves, and I know a lot of these HVAC companies, as part of the service that they do, they need to either remotely monitor the systems, mm-hmm. remotely access the systems in some capacity. So a lot of these HVAC companies have perpetual connections to these organizations that they're setting up these systems right. for.
Okay. And so it might not necessarily be, so that's a case where the actual small business, the contractor created a problem for Target, the larger one. But so let me ask this question then. Even in a company like ours, right, we don't have those connections to our customer systems.
Yeah.
Right. So why are you so adamant that we bolster our security even in a company like this?
Yeah, because
why is that important?
Is your company valuable to you is what it comes down to, right? I mean, if you were attacked by a malicious actor and your business was down for 3 days, a week, what is that worth to you, right? Mm-hmm. What does that cost your business? What does that cost you as the owner? What does that cost your employees? There's a lot of value there, and mm-hmm. these companies know that. And one of the largest attacks that goes on right now is called ransomware, right? So that's where these malicious actors will find their way into your network either through an exploit of your firewall, through someone clicking a bad link in an email, et cetera. They get access to your network. They don't destroy your data. They take your data ransom. So mm-hmm. they encrypt it all. They send you an email or some sort of a note on your computer saying, hey, we've encrypted all of your data. You can't get it. And your only recourse is to recover from backup. Backup is very important. We'll go over that a little more in detail. But either recover from backup or the only other alternative is to pay these bad actors whatever amount of money they stipulate that you mm-hmm. need to pay them. And the scary part is they give you your data back in most instances when you pay them that money, which is why they're so well-funded, why they're propagating so much, because you know you pay them this money, they give you your data back, and that's really, unfortunately, if you don't have something to restore from, the only recourse you have in those situations.
Sure. And actually, we experienced that here.
Yeah.
At one point at Grandy, and that I remember sitting at my desk one time and literally seeing every file just go down the list, and the file extensions were changing down the list, and I remember calling you, and you're going, "Okay, just shut it off, unplug it, get it off of the network."
Yeah.
Because that then not only affects that machine, it affects every other machine.
It's a scary position to be in.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. So, yeah, is there a so many customers today? The end user customers are paying these companies that we're referring to, the contractors across the country, with credit card or debit cards. Is that information something that we need to worry about? Exposing or being stolen if somebody breaks into our system?
Yeah, so if you're an organization that is taking payment, especially by credit card, you need to abide by what's called PCI compliance or payment credit card industry compliance. Mm-hmm. Some of those things, you know, there's a lot to it to stay compliant. You want to be conscious of it, but it's simple things. It's making sure that whatever devices are taking those credit card transactions are segregated on your network, so that those devices can't talk to anything else on your network. They can essentially just talk to whatever your payment card processing software is and then to the internet. It's keeping those things separate mm-hmm. so they stay safe.
Okay.
Right? So, obviously you don't want to be writing customers' credit cards numbers down, all mm-hmm. that. Just adds to vulnerabilities and stuff.
Well, so that reminds me, right? I mean, 85% of contractors across the country use QuickBooks. I go into QuickBooks and under payment information, it gives me the ability to put in customers' credit card number.
Yeah.
If I'm putting it there, I mean, somebody could steal my QuickBooks file.
Well, so these softwares, typically, when you're using a piece of software that you're putting sensitive information into, you need to make sure that the software that you're using is trustworthy and mm-hmm. secure. You also need to make sure that the network that it exists on is secure, right? Mm-hmm. So it's taking those precautionary steps. It's essentially like trying to patch Swiss trees when you're talking about keeping yourself secure. You want to patch as many holes as you can. You're never going to patch them all, but it's really just mitigating as much risk as you can mm-hmm. and making sure you're using safe software and on a safe, secure network is some of those holes that you want to help keep patched.
All right, so that brings up another question for me is, okay, you know, Todd, you came to me a year ago and told me that I needed to put in or this firewall or I needed to, what? It's in, I'm good, right? I'm done, I don't have to worry about it anymore. I can check that off the list and not worry about it, right?
Yeah, so, and that's kind of what I'm speaking to, is you want to, when we're working with small businesses, you're never going to be 100% safe, right? You're always going to have a little bit of risk. It's mitigating as much risk as you can and really doing it in a cost-effective way. Because mm-hmm. you can throw as much money in as you want at a problem, and there's still going to be a chance of a problem at the end of it. Really what you want to do as a small business owner is speak with someone who can guide you in a direction to say, okay, I've got this much budget that I can commit to securing my network. Where's the most cost-effective ways that I can, what are the most cost-effective technologies that I can implement today that will secure me and I can get the most bang for my buck as far as investing in my infrastructure?
Where, deal with the areas of greatest bleeding first.
Exactly.
Yep. Okay. And the other thing that, because I know you've come to me a time or two and have said, okay, Bill, we need to improve this area of your network. And then a year or two later, you come back and say, okay, we need to go back and revisit that area. Isn't it? It's either there or it's not.
So the world of security is ever-changing, right? There's always new risks that are out there. And as technology and security becomes more prevalent, bad actors find different areas to attack. A really good example of this is antivirus, right? Mm. It used to be in the day, back in the day, IT professionals always just said, make sure you have antivirus. And that was a chorus that was kind of sung over and over again. Mm-hmm. Antivirus is still important today.
Right.
It's not that it's not important. It's just that bad actors understand that most people, most businesses have antivirus implemented now. Mm-hmm. It still patches a really big hole. There's still a lot of malicious software that gets into a network and is blocked by antivirus. Mm-hmm. But these people doing these things know that most places have antivirus in place now, so that's not as successful of an attack. These days, we're seeing stuff like social engineering attacks, phishing attacks. Those are really common now, and those are a lot more successful. I can kind of explain.
So, yeah, real briefly, and I know because, again, we're going to get into a couple of these areas in more detail. What is a social engineering attack?
Yeah, so a social engineering attack, you can think of it, you know, back in the day you got these really poorly worded emails where it was, if you send me $1,000, I'll send you $10,000.
Oh, I mean, right? The one that I got last week from the king of wherever.
And you shouldn't have responded to it. I'm hoping I've taught you at least that well. Okay. Yeah, so unfortunately, those emails have become a lot more sophisticated, right? Mm-hmm. Now they consist of emails that don't have as many grammatical errors. They have, you know, the Microsoft logo on the upper left-hand corner. It looks very legitimate. Mm-hmm. When you click on it, it says something to the effect of, you know, your Microsoft password has expired. Click this link to change it. Mm-hmm. What happens is you click that link. It brings you to a website that looks very much like the Microsoft website that you're familiar with, mm-hmm. but it's not. It's essentially a different website. You type your password in, and then all of a sudden, unfortunately, whoever sent that email now has your Microsoft password. That's essentially a phishing attack.
Okay. And that is, so it's phishing attack, that's the same as the
social engineering, yeah.
Social engineering, okay.
That type of phishing attack sort of falls under the umbrella of social engineering. Social engineering isn't me as a bad guy sending you an email that has a bad file in it. It's me engineering a situation to get data that's valuable to me.
Yep.
Okay. Right? So they're engineering essentially the end users to either trick them or mislead them into giving over information that they're looking for.
Got it. All right. Okay, so you've convinced me. I guess I need to continue with my IT security.
Mission accomplished. So
you've got 6 pillars of security that you talk about.
Yeah.
Right? And the first one, you kind of dabbled into that just a little bit, being antivirus. Where do we need to really be looking at that? And again, is if I have it, because every computer wants me to put it on,
yeah.
right? And I know I could put it on, but I don't want to pay the subscription.
Yeah. So most businesses use Windows as their operating system platform, mm-hmm. right? Windows does come with a product called Windows Defender. Mm-hmm. It is a built-in product that does basic antivirus technology, and it's got some firewall technology and stuff built in. We do still recommend, as a business, having a paid-for antivirus solution. Not all antivirus is created equal. Mm-hmm. A lot of the new paid-for products use what's called next-generation antivirus technology. And those are using things like, it used to be where your antivirus once a month would download what are called signatures. Mm-hmm. And signatures are essentially known viruses. That way, if your antivirus software has downloaded a signature for a virus that already exists, mm-hmm. if you get infected with that, it can effectively block it.
Okay.
These newer next generation antivirus technologies essentially sync with the cloud so that they're ever updated. So if you're using a virus technology platform that's also used by 1,000 other companies across the United States that all connect to this cloud database. Mm-hmm. If a computer in California yesterday got a virus and it's a part of that cloud database, your computer here in Green Bay is now also aware of that virus. So it's much faster than it used to be.
Okay.
So it's technologies like that. They also use some predictive analytics stuff where they sort of learn how you use your individual computer. And if you're doing something that really doesn't look right, they can block some of those processes. So there's a lot of technology into it. They're not all created equal. The one other nice thing about the paid-for products is they do stuff like alerting and reporting. So if you've got a bunch of end users out in the field who are using devices that have antivirus technology on, you're not so much relying on them to see an antivirus message pop up. You can have those alerted to either management or your IT provider, and then they can reach out to that person and say, hey, it looks like your computer may have gotten infected with something. Can we take a look?
So that social engineering attack, that something that this might catch?
So it can. So some antivirus technologies have some stuff that fights against some social engineering attacks. Social engineering attacks are more readily defended with stuff like content filters and email filters.
Okay.
So those are two big things that essentially...
And we'll be getting into some of those as well coming up.
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
Yep. All right. So we'll hit pause on that one for a moment then. So one of the things that I've done, so tell me if this is a good idea, right? I'm admitting this live to you, is when I see those phishing attacks come in, those emails come in where, hey, your Microsoft password is about to expire within 24 hours, whatever, click here to reset it, is I'll take just a screen grab of that.
Sure.
Right, and I'll email it to my team telling them, hey, guys, again, just be aware, these are coming in, they're hitting us regularly. Here's an example of what the screen might look like, but since it's just a screenshot, there's nothing active to it.
Yep.
Be aware, you will never receive an email to reset your Microsoft password. That'll happen when you're actually logging onto your computer, something like that, right?
Yeah,
now, just kind of let them know that, hey, these are out there. They're hitting us regularly. Do not click on them. Do not do that. Does that make sense to do that?
That's great. Honestly, one of the best things that you can do as a company is train your employees.
Okay.
Because at the end of the day, the biggest risk is the person behind the mouse, right? Mm-hmm. You need to train them. You need to have those conversations regularly so that you're kind of reestablishing the fact that, like you said, those threats are out there. Be aware of them. Don't always trust what you see with your eyes.
The person behind the mouse. I like that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
I like to have a big old mouse trap that when they actually click on it, it comes back and nabs their fingers, right? Okay. So that's antivirus, right? We need to have that. Needs to be current. Needs to be ever updating.
Correct. Yep.
Okay. All right. So that's good. Let's look at the next one. You mentioned the idea of the second pillar being content filtering. What is content filtering?
Yeah. So content filtering is essentially... something that you can put in place with your IT professional that you're working with, where you set it up on your network, on your company-owned devices, that tells the device what websites it can and cannot go to. Right, so you can look at it a few different ways. Companies use content filters for different things. One of the big things is a lot of them know what a lot of the dark websites are, the bad websites are, the malicious websites are, and they can block those just across the board as default. You can also do regional blocking. So if there's, you know, a lot of attacks right now are coming from Russia, so you can actually IP block entire regions of the world so that your computer or the computers on your network can't get to any website coming from a specific place geographically.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Another thing that you can use content filtering for is actually just to keep efficiencies up. So you can block stuff like social media websites, time-wasting websites, that kind of thing.
Ah, okay.
Yep.
All right. So they can't go back and check their whatever game they're playing or see how they're
exactly.
doing, right? All right. The thought just hit me, right? We're moving into the whole 5G world.
Yeah.
Right? And the Internet of Things.
Yep.
And again, 5G having so much more capability in terms of bandwidth. And so, therefore, it's just exploding the number of things that have internet connectivity.
Yeah.
Does that factor into either of these, or are we going to get into that a little bit later on?
So it sort of factors into it. The way that I think of it is, and what you might be getting to is, your network and your data doesn't necessarily live within four walls, right? You need to protect your network as it exists within your physical spaces. But if you've got employees that work either in customer homes or out on the road or out of their trucks, a lot of times they have mobile devices that are connected to 5G cellular networks.
Right.
A lot of this technology isn't dependent on it being connected to your local network within your walls. A lot of these antivirus and content filtering solutions can actually be installed on the device. That way, that protection is with them regardless of what network they're connected to.
All right. So then that does bring up the other question, right? So many today are using a tablet or something like that in the field, in the customer's home. Do I need to, because I always hear that, right? I use an Apple device because I don't have to worry about viruses.
Not true, unfortunately. Okay. I wish that that was the case. Back a few years ago, it was true that the majority of viruses and malware and all that did tend to favor Windows devices. Most of that being because the Apple platform, right, you can install a lot less on it. It's got to all come through the Apple Store, and mm-hmm. they're a little bit more stringent as far as what can be installed on those devices. But as we kind of talked about with the social engineering attacks too, that doesn't necessarily rely on software anymore. So it really is more a part of making sure the end user is educated and really limiting what those devices have access to keep them protected.
Sure. Okay. And I think today that's so important because so many, some of the younger generation grew up living on these things.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And so they're not afraid to go anywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? I mean, they'll visit whatever site, right?
Yeah.
And so sometimes that can create some problems for us.
Yeah.
All right. So let's hit pillar number three then, quality backup.
Yeah, so this one I personally think is the most important. I always tell my customers, especially when I'm kind of going through this with them for the first time, it's a lot. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of information. You don't really know where to start necessarily. One of the things I say first and foremost is backup sort of supersedes everything. And when I say backup, what I really mean is having backup, right? Backing your data up so that if it does get compromised or deleted, either accidentally or intentionally by someone malicious, you can get it back. But also having what we call a continuity solution in place and a recovery solution in place, because it's not just making sure my data is backed up. It's if something bad happens where I can't get to my data, what's the process to get it back? What does that look like? Are we talking a few hours? Are we talking a few days? Are we talking a few weeks? So it's really understanding that you need to back your data up in a way that's secure and that you trust and that you can test, but also that you can restore it in the case that you need to. Because that's where a lot of people kind of say, yep, I've got a backup. I've got it backed up to this thing on my network. It's also backed up in the cloud, which is a really good thing to back it up in more than one spot. But you really need to think it all the way through to, all right, if something bad happens, how do I get it back?
So, yeah, and let's talk about that for a little bit, because you and I have had this conversation at one point in time. Mm-hmm. We used to use an offsite backup, and as we looked at it, okay, so it was backed up every night, did the incremental backup, so anything that was newer, was changed, was backed up to the cloud. But the problem was in that restoring.
Yeah.
Right, that not all of those services are equal. Isn't it just a matter of, okay, grab this entire backup and restore it, and 2 hours later I'm up and running?
Yeah, unfortunately not. You really do need a process that you've documented and that you've laid out so that you understand, number one, so that expectations aren't skewed, so that as the business owner understand that, okay, in the event that, a few files are deleted, this is what it looks like to restore. In the event that the whole system is compromised or there's a big hardware failure, this is what it looks like to restore. So it's really talking through that, making sure expectations are correct. And if you as a business owner say, I can't be down for a day, I can't be down for 2 days, then it's okay, well, the solution you ask costs this and this is what you get out of it. If you want to be able to be back up in a few hours, that's this solution, that costs this much, and this is what you get out of it.
Because a lot of it's not limited to the actual service. It could be limited by the internet connection that you have in your building.
Oh, for sure, yeah. I mean, if it's a matter of, so that's why, maybe I should back up for a second. So essentially, when you're talking about a backup solution, really what you want is, you want your data to be backed up both on-site and off-site in an encrypted way. And if it's a situation where, maybe your server was compromised and that thing needs to be restored, as long as your on-site backup hadn't been compromised, the time to restore that from your local backup to your local server across your local network within your building is going to be much quicker than if maybe your server and your on-site backup were destroyed and you have to restore from the cloud.
A fire in the building, something for whatever reason,
exactly.
That's gone.
Exactly. If it's something where... if it's a really bad disaster, where you're talking about tornado, all those really, really bad things where everything in the building is maybe disrupted and you have to restore from the cloud, then you are dependent on what's your internet connection, how long does it take to download all that. That's when you could be talking about maybe a few days instead of a few hours.
Sure. Okay. And for the most part, when you're trying to do those, it's not like you can say, okay, I want to take these files first and these ones second, right? Yeah, I'm doing the restore, yeah. and they're all coming over.
Unfortunately not. Yeah, when you're talking about restoring an entire system, you're talking about all the files and the operating system and all the user stuff, all the network services maybe. So you're restoring that really as a whole thing, and it's really not accessible until the whole thing is restored.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's a challenge. Okay, very good. And so again, I'll go back to with the work that you did here in our building when we did get that the ransomware in our building, right? We literally took that machine offline. We were able to basically go back and, you know, because we're not paying ransomware. It just ain't going to happen. Yeah. So that's why we have the backups there. We were able to basically go back, restore all the machines, and we were back up and running in relatively short order.
Yeah, and that's critical. And you kind of spoke to something there too. You know, one other piece of note is, If you ever do see something that looks suspicious on your computer, and this is just sort of a general recommendation, even if it's always better to be more cautious than less cautious, right? Mm-hmm. So if you see something on your computer, or your computer starts, sometimes they start talking to you, trying to you know, talk you into doing bad things. If you ever see something suspicious on your computer, take it off the network. Either find out where your network cable is, unplug it. If you really can't find any of that, shut the thing down. Because what you don't want is if there is something bad on your computer to propagate across your network and infect more devices. And that's what a lot of these ransomware type ones do, right? They won't infect the server itself. They'll infect a computer, and then by means of your network, they get to other computers, they get to your server. So if you ever do see something that doesn't quite look right, you're always safest to just shut it down. Hold the power button until it shuts down. In most situations, you don't want to do that because it's not great for the computer. But if you are in a situation where you think, hey, this doesn't look right, this is making me nervous, hold the power button, shut it down, and then talk to your IT professional, and they can help guide you through the rest.
Yep, absolutely. Very good. All right, so that's three pillars down. All right, let's talk about pillar number four, employee training.
Yeah, so if backup is the most important thing, this is certainly 1A, because you can have good antivirus, you can have good backup, you can have a good firewall, you can have all those things in place. Unfortunately, every big study shows the biggest risk to an employee or company's network is the people using the devices, right? It's making sure that employees recognize that phishing attacks do exist, and that if they get an email telling them to reset a password, to make sure that they're consulting the administrators of that platform, making sure that it's legitimate, or deleting it if they really think it's suspicious. It's making sure that you're having those regular conversations. A lot of times what I tell my customers to do is you don't need to be talking about this stuff every day, right? It doesn't need to be a conversation that you're because otherwise people sort of become numb to it and they sort of forget about it, right? Mm-hmm. What I would suggest is if you have a quarterly meeting, even twice a year, maybe if you're having a meeting with your whole staff and you're getting folks together on a semi-regular basis, take 10 minutes, have your IT people, create a little slide deck that has a few examples. Examples are great because you can, visually see an example of what they might encounter in the real world.
Sure.
And just go through that with your employees on a semi-regular basis. It doesn't need to be a three-hour-long seminar, once a quarter, but, just take 20 minutes, get those slides in front of your employees, kind of bring it top of mind again so that they understand that there are threats out there. And it is somewhat their responsibility to fight against that a little
bit. Yeah, and when they see it, they recognize it. This is what it is. Okay, that makes total sense. I probably every other month or so, I'll have a couple of minutes on it where I'm talking about it just for the, within our team here.
Yeah, that's great.
Okay, very good. Next one, email filtering.
Yeah, so just the way we talked about the content filtering and content filtering limits what websites your devices can get to. Email filtering is either a physical device that lives on your network, or a lot of times these days it's actually something that lives up in the cloud. Okay. So if you don't have an email filter in place, if I send you, Bill, an email, it goes from my email server to your email server. What an email filter is, it actually sits between those two things. So when I send
It's a physical device.
It can be a physical device. Back in the old days, that was primarily what it was, is you would have a physical device on your network. That was because you also had a physical server on your site where your email went to. A lot of times the email services these days are in the cloud, so these web filters also live in the cloud.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially what would happen is if I send you an email, instead of it going from my email server to your email server, it first goes to this email filter device. Mm-hmm. And what this email filter device does is it is set up to scan the email, mm-hmm. right? So this filter, it opens the email, it looks at any attachments on the email, and then based on a set of parameters that you set up with your IT professional, it either blocks the email entirely. If mm-hmm. it's something that's clearly bad, the email filter knows it's bad, it'll block it, or it can put it into what's called quarantine.
Okay.
And quarantine is essentially a separate mailbox that's assigned to each user that has a real mailbox on that system. And it sort of just sets it off to the side. And then it emails you, the person who the email was supposed to go to originally, and it says, yep. Hey, we flagged this thing. It looks like it might be suspicious. We put it in our quarantine section so that you're aware of it and can look at it, but mm-hmm. you might just want to be cautious when you open it, right? And then you as the end user can decide, hey, this thing got flagged. Maybe I don't want to open it.
Right, or maybe I contact the person who supposedly sent it to me to find out what it is.
Exactly, yeah. Okay. So the email filters, they block bad stuff. They also block stuff that's going to waste your time, right? So they block unsolicited emails. They block mass marketing emails. So, mm-hmm. you know, if you're one of those people who gets 400 or 500 emails in a day from a bunch of unsolicited people that you don't care to see, it can filter a lot of that out well and really sure. increase productivity that way.
Okay. Now, there's some cases where, so we've got a client or two that we work with that our emails were flagged on their system.
Sure.
Right? But we work with these guys all the time. And so is there a way that we can get around that piece of the puzzle?
You can, right? So these email filters have what's called a blacklist and a whitelist. Okay. And a blacklist is something that you can implement if you know that you definitely don't want to receive an email from an entity that's still coming through. Maybe it's not unsolicited. Maybe it's not necessarily a scary email, but it's just, I don't want to receive this from them, so you can put them on the blacklist. That way, okay. if they send it to you, it'll get stopped by the mail filter.
It'll just automatically be blocked, even though it may not be virus or anything like that. It's just...
Exactly. It's just something that you don't care to see that you don't need to receive from this person in the yep. future. The inverse of that is what we call a whitelist. So okay. if you are getting an email sent to you from someone that you work with on a regular basis, and maybe it's just flagging it for some ancillary reason. These filters aren't 100% accurate, right?
Right.
They sort of look at an email, they give it a score, and then if the score is high enough, they block it, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe this person you know is good, you work with them on a regular basis, it's still getting flagged by the email filter, but you're like, nope, I need to see this. You can put it on the white list, and then it sort of is just exempted from the email filter system, mm-hmm. and then you receive it. The one note I would say on that is... people can abuse that, right? So you need to be conscious of that too, because if you are too free with your whitelist,
okay.
you can have, I've seen customers who have employees who sort of take advantage of that. And the problem with once you exempt an email address is it's not being scanned by the email filter anymore. So just be conscious okay. of the fact that even if you do stuff with a customer or some other entity on a regular basis where you feel the need to whitelist them, if they ever do get corrupted or if they ever do get compromised on their side, those emails from them aren't being scanned anymore. So you want to be aware that you can whitelist stuff, but you want to be cautious of using it too much.
Sure. So, and I'll give the example, right? So in ours, we actually send out a weekly email every Thursday about the upcoming virtual training programs and remote training programs that we have. And again, if we stop sending it, we get a lot of contractors that are going, hey, I haven't seen, you know, what's the upcoming, you know, that you've got? And this particular company, many of their employees utilize that on a regular basis.
Sure.
But the IT group flagged that as a promotional or
bulk
type of mm-hmm. an email and therefore flagged it. And so nobody in the company was getting it anymore. Oh, and that's sure. the way we originally found out, is because the employers are going, you guys haven't sent us an update on what the upcoming classes are. We got people, we want to get into them, but we, you know, and so
yeah.
that was a process we ended up having to deal with there, and this was a multi-state company, so had to end up deal with their director of IT to get ourselves whitelisted at that point and
yep.
be able to send through.
And those are the situations that whitelist is kind of made for.
Okay, and so then let me ask this, because it also goes in here, is that am I whitelisting or blacklisting mm-hmm. a specific email or a entire company, or what are some of those parameters?
Yes and yes. So typically whitelisting can be done on either the email address level, where you are saying, I want to receive anything from bill@grandyandassociates.com,
okay.
or you can whitelist the whole domain. And the domain name is really everything after the @.
Sure.
Right? So if you want to receive anything from a specific company, you can whitelist the whole domain name, and that means anyone that sends with anything at that domain name will be exempted and allowed through.
So as long as the email is anything at grandyassociates.com.
Correct.
It would be able to come through.
Yep.
Okay. Very good. And in fact, in my example, that's exactly what they did because we've got multiple people who are managing and communicating with them. All right. So that's five pillars. Then we move into network segmentation. What is network segmentation?
Yeah. So a good example, actually, is when I talked about the PCI compliance before, right? Okay. If you're taking credit card transactions, you are segmenting off the devices that can do those transactions so that they can only get to what they need to get to, which is essentially the software or whatever is running the transaction on that workstation or that terminal, and then the internet. So you're segmenting off that stuff so that if another section of your network gets infected with something, it is not able to get to those devices taking the credit card transactions. Another good example.
Yeah. All right. I'll ask my question in a minute, right? Because that just spurs a few of them for me.
Okay. The other good example I think of when I think of network segmentation is a lot of times businesses will have customers coming in to their business where they want to give them guest internet, right? They want them to be able to hop on their Wi-Fi to just add it as a courtesy service. You don't want those devices on what that guest network is to be able to get to your business network. So it's really, if you are providing guest internet access, you want to make sure that that is segmented from your internal business network so that those users can, you know, jump on their iPhones, get to the internet, do what they need to do as a courtesy, but that they can't get to your workstations or your data or your server or any of that. So you're segmenting the guest network from the business network.
So then the same question still pops into my head. You know, like in our building, right, we've got the switch. That's up there, and every computer in the building is wired back to that switch. So I've got all these; it's all plugged into the same device. Right? Yep. I mean, it's not like I can cut that thing in half. How do I segment a device if I've got one computer that I don't want? I mean, isn't it all accessible?
Yeah, so it all plugs into the same piece. You're right; it all plugs into the same piece of hardware in your network closet. All that segmenting, all that separating is done virtually on that switch itself.
Okay.
So essentially you're saying on that switch, hey, these eight ports I want to be, these eight, maybe it's eight workstations that take credit card transactions, right? Just a number. Maybe it's those eight workstations are on these eight ports. You tell that switch, hey, these eight ports are their own private network so that only those eight workstations can talk to each other. They can talk to the software they need to get to in the internet, but those eight ports can't talk to any of the other 20 ports on that switch.
Okay.
So really it's at the virtual level on that hardware that you're actually segmenting these networks.
Okay, so I know a lot of companies, right, they'll have that exact scenario that you just laid out, right? I've got these five machines are all going to be accepting credit cards, right, different people in the company.
Yep.
So we're going to segment those, but can that group of segmented computers then still, we have our shared drive that everybody in the building accesses. Can it still have access to that and remain segmented?
Yeah, so a lot of times with these PCI compliances, you need to fill out a form. And if you've got instances where, and it really depends on the software too. There's a lot of things that come into play when you talk about segmenting these credit card terminals if they are workstations that need to access other things. It's making sure that they can only get to what they need to get to. It's working with the credit card transaction processors because a lot of times there's forms that need to be filled out where if they need to get to other stuff, it's justifying what they need to get to and it's making a business case for it, making sure that you stay within compliance.
Okay, and I know we have to fill out, do our annual audit every year to remain compliant, that here's what is accessible or what isn't. So one of the other questions that came up, and this was an example that, again, we experienced here recently, was you came to me and said, you know, Bill, looking at all the devices on your network, you know, in our particular case, a lot of the employees have their smartphones and they'll connect to the Wi-Fi network here in the building. And so we've got, you know, smartphones and tablets and all this other stuff that's on the network. And you recommended that those users no longer connect to the standard network, that they connect to the guest network.
Yeah. And there's good reason for that. So a lot of times, just a basic network will consist of like two wireless networks, one that's made for business purposes and one that's made for what we call guest or customer services. Typically, what I recommend is only put stuff on the business Wi-Fi that needs to get to business resources, right? So if it's a company laptop or even a company phone that you need to print from, that would need to be on the business one because that network is where your printer lives. if it's just a phone that your employee is using for their personal stuff and you're letting them connect to the Wi-Fi as a courtesy of the business, even those devices, keep those on the guest network because they don't need to use any of the company resources. They don't need to maybe do any printing. And it's all about mitigating risk, right? Mm-hmm. The odds of a phone getting infected and that virus propagating across your network to your workstations and your server is small, but it's not completely negligible where you want to just mitigate that risk if you can. So if that cell phone only needs to get to the internet, put it on the network that can only get to the internet that can't get to your business.
Because I could say if that's on my business network and that employee goes out to some website, right, we've just opened up the door into our business network.
Exactly.
Okay. Yep. All right. So that makes a lot of sense there. A lot of businesses right now, in our case, we've got a fairly large switch, right? Mm-hmm. So that's in there. That's tying all these computers together in the network. But a lot of businesses just have the local, D-Link or Linksys router with the 4 or 5 ports on the back of it. Is segmentation available on those as well?
Some yes, some no. A lot of those, if you're truly a smaller business that's just using maybe the firewall that the internet provider provides to you, mm-hmm. And maybe just plugging into the back of that device, a lot of times you won't have that available to you as an option. Luckily, a lot of this technology we're talking about, we're not talking tens of thousands of dollars or even thousands mm-hmm. of dollars. A lot of this stuff can be fairly inexpensively implemented and set up, mm-hmm. And you don't need to invest all this money. It's really knowing where to stake your dollars to get the most out of it. And most of the things I've talked about, you're not talking about a lot of money. You're just talking about having the knowledge of knowing where to put that money.
Sure. Okay. And so that makes a lot of sense as we continue to dig into this thing. Mm-hmm. So one of the other items that that I think about, in terms of the entire security of my network is, and you kind of alluded to it a little bit earlier, is if that system goes down, right? And the analogy I always use, right? So many business owners go, yeah, I hate computers, right? I don't want to replace them. I don't want to, right? But what happens when the computer doesn't work? Right? You don't get anything done, right?
Yeah.
How much of your business today is reliant on that computer functioning?
I mean, most of it. I mean, it's not a lot that you're doing on pen and paper these days, right? Right. So, and the other question that I would ask is, you talk about backing up stuff that's on your server. Another thing to be conscious of is there's a lot of data that maybe doesn't live on the server that's still really important to your business. So it's, are users saving files in their documents and on their desktop of their local computers? If they are, that stuff might not be backed up. And you're not always good privy point. To that because you're not watching each of your employees of where they're saving their stuff. You can say, make sure you're saving it on your home drive, make sure you're saving it on your server, but you don't necessarily know where they're saving that stuff. So it's being conscious of that. A lot of that goes back to training, right? Mm-hmm. Making sure that they're doing that. There are other things that you can set up. There's a lot of cloud-based file services now and file duplication services. You think of Microsoft OneDrive and Google Drive. A lot of those things have business sides of those mm-hmm. Utilities as well, where you can actually set them up on a workstation so that even if our users are saving things in their local desktops, mm-hmm. it will then also be duplicated to one of those cloud storage platforms. So that's kind of the direction a lot of our customers are going, is implementing a lot of those cloud technologies. It's easier now that internet's gotten better and is mm-hmm. continuing to get better, right? It used to be a lot of places still had slower internet. It was hard to be uploading files constantly that were being synced. But now that internet is really really improving, it's a lot easier to set up maybe those cloud-based duplication softwares.
Sure. Okay. The other question that I guess we've covered our six pillars, and mm-hmm. those are really six important areas, and they all kind of they intertwine just a little bit, but they're all critical.
Yeah.
So the other question that I have then is in terms of computers, computer hardware, and let's first start with servers. What's the average life of a server? I mean, at what point should I be? Because that's a fairly major piece of equipment. In terms of my company, how long is it realistic Or at what point should I start planning on looking at a replacement for that thing?
Yeah, so usually we say, and again, these are, you know, always give and take, but usually we say 4 to 6 years. Mm-hmm. And the reason we say that is because usually the hardware vendor usually has a warranty that's going to be about that length, right? Anywhere from 4 to 6 to 7 years typically. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is the operating systems that these servers are running on only have a certain lifespan as well. So mm-hmm. you got to kind of look at, you know, how old is the hardware? How old is the software that it's running? Take those things into consideration and then come up with an idea of when you want to cycle that out. But usually you're talking 4 to 6 years.
All right. So then that kind of brings me into the second area is what about workstations? Is there a guideline there or is it the same?
It's a little more flexible on the workstation side just because when you talk about getting out of a warranty on your server, servers have a lot more pieces to them and the data usually is a lot more critical or should be a lot more critical than you're talking about on a workstation. Mm-hmm. So once you're out of the warranty period from your vendor on your server, if a hard drive dies, it's harder to get that stuff, it's harder to get it timely, and it's usually more expensive once you're towards the end of a life. When you're talking about a workstation, usually we say about the same time frame, generally 4 to 6 years. People, you know, that's an area where you can push it a little more. Mm-hmm. You can go a little further out on those. You still need to be cognizant of that your operating system is supported. That's really important because once Microsoft stops supporting your operating system, they're no longer coming out with what are called security patches. So if, you know, if you're, forbid, even still using Windows 7 or an outdated operating system, mm-hmm. even if you've got antivirus on it and you've got content filters, all of that stuff is really negated by the fact that the vendor of the operating system themselves is no longer securing that. So even if you've got antivirus, it's not doing a whole lot once the operating system isn't supported.
And really, I think the reason for that is because these individuals who are going to try and hack into systems know that, quite frankly, that system is not being updated anymore. They know that it's going to be far more vulnerable going exactly. forward, so they're willing to spend a little bit more time on it.
Exactly. Yep. Okay. Absolutely.
Very good. And so how long does Microsoft support the operating systems?
So it sort of depends. It's fluctuated. If you're talking about a server, it's usually about 10 years.
Okay.
Right? 10 years, give or take.
So if I can interrupt you there for a moment, they support the operating system for 10 years, but that doesn't mean you can keep the server for 10 years because you may have bought the server 6 or 7 years into that particular operating system.
Correct. Like server 2019 is a very prevalent operating system for servers right now. That goes end of what they call extended support. And that there's a few different milestones when you talk about a server's or an operating system's life. There's mainstream support where they're patching a lot of stuff on a server mm-hmm. as these server patches come out. And then there's extended support and they will do the main security patches until the end of extended support. So that's why that extended support is really the end of the life cycle for the operating system. Server 2019 came out around 2019. They're doing extended support up into, I forget what month of 2029. So right about 10 years.
Got it. Yep. And then on a workstation?
It varies a little bit. So right now, Windows 10 is being supported. There were a few different iterations of Windows 10. Mm-hmm. So the early Windows 10 isn't necessarily the same operating system per se as later versions of Windows 10. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, the latest versions of Windows 10 are currently being supported until middle end of 2025.
Okay.
So that's going to be Windows 11. Yeah, exactly.
And Windows 11 is being released now. And it's,
correct, yep.
Okay. Very good. And then I guess the last question that I've got on those updates is, again, you've always warned me, don't jump on an operating system upgrade too soon.
Yeah.
Right. Or a new release, I think.
Yeah, so don't jump on switching to a new operating system just because, you know, you're talking about Windows 11 right now is kind of where everyone's going, right? There's still a lot of workstations on Windows 10. As you move to Windows 11, there's things to consider. The compatibility is pretty good. Mm-hmm. So I know when we were jumping from like Windows back in the day, like Windows XP to Windows 7 and then Windows 7 to Windows 10, there were a lot of like software compatibility considerations you needed to make. It's a pretty clean migration from Windows 10 to Windows 11. So a lot of it really is, do I want to switch operating systems right now? And the user interface is a little bit different, right? So there are things to be cognizant of when you're making a full operating system upgrade. As far as Windows patches, our recommendation at this point is to essentially, especially the security patches, is to implement them as soon as they come out.
Okay.
Really, as soon as they're released, you're good to install those. There is always risk. It used to be more prevalent. It does still happen where a Windows update will break something. That's always a possibility. Mm-hmm. But the risk of going without a security patch sort of supersedes the slight risk of it breaking something.
Sure. Okay. Well, that certainly makes sense. Well, that a lot of information in a short period of time here. Any final thoughts that you've got for us in regards to the entire area of network security or IT security?
I guess I'd kind of go back to where I started is there's a lot to it, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, as the owner of a business or as a person who is at least responsible for making sure that the business I'm working for needs to be secure, we need to be conscious of IT. You need to be aware of that, and you need to find the resources to help guide you. And the one thing I would say is it is overwhelming, right? I mean, there's a lot to it. You really want to be conscious of the fact that you're never going to be 100% protected, which sounds scary, but it's mm-hmm. the truth, right? And the reason it's important to understand that is you want to make mindful upgrades to your network that are going to benefit you the most given given what you have as far as the budget goes.
Sure.
So you really want to work with a professional that's going to guide you in a direction that is going to get you where you need to go, understanding that there's never an end to it. It's sure. It's always going to be being conscious of it over time. You're not shooting for an end to this game. It's always just being conscious of the fact that these threats exist, they're ever changing, and it really is your responsibility to be mindful of that and to fight against that.
Yeah, no question. Well, Todd, thanks. Excellent information.
All right, thanks, Bill.
As always, we welcome your feedback on each month's presentation. Please feel free to give us a call at 877-202-8891. The vision of Grandy & Associates is quite simple. We teach companies how to run profitable businesses. For more information on how we do that, check out our website at www.grandyassociates.com or give us a call at 1-877-202-8891. Profit University Audio Series is produced and distributed by Grandy & Associates. If we can be of service to you, give us a call on our toll-free line at 1-877-202-8891. Until next month, remember, invest your time and invest your money in those things that will reproduce.